listening to the Tune and Talk Podcast, Episode 20, Interview with Joseph Philip Illich. Hello and welcome to the Tune and Talk Podcast, brought to you by Fanboy Nation. It is your rendezvous for animation interviews, and I am your host, Whitney Grace, and I am proud to announce we have reached episode 20 of this podcast. Yay! Woohoo! And I am partying by myself in my recording studio, which doubles as my closet. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the best acoustics I can get in my house are in my closet. As I had mentioned in the previous two episodes, I had headed down to DragonCon 2015 in Atlanta, Georgia, and I have to tell you, I had a blast. I was spending about 12, 14 hours at the convention center wandering between hotels and meeting some really great people who work in the animation, puppetry, and anime industry. I made some really cool contacts for future episode interviews, and I made some really good connections with a lot of puppetry folks. For those who don't know me, I am a huge, and I mean huge, puppetry fan. Not just the Muppets, but we're talking, you know, shadow puppetry, marionettes, Bunraku. If it is an inanimate object that is turned into a puppet, I want to see it because I just love the medium. It's another illusion of life. And as with animation, as with puppetry, you can do anything. And one of the main reasons why I went down to the convention was to make some connections with puppetry folk who might have some further insight into Lotta Reiniger, who, if you have been listening to my show, was the director of the longest known surviving animated movie, The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, and she was also a puppeteer as well, specializing in silhouette, also known as shadow puppetry. And one of the things I really enjoyed about DragonCon is, for the first time in my life, and you might not believe this because I'm writing a book about shadow puppetry, but I was able to see my first live shadow puppetry show. Everything else up to this point has been either recording or on TV or, you know, just a short blurb or clip in a movie. I'll be discussing more about my DragonCon 2015 escapade in the next episode, because episode 21's guest is a puppeteer, and he has this really, really extensive resume when it comes to television and film puppetry. He's worked in everything from children's television to shows made for a more adult audience. And I'm not going to say who it is, but when you listen to the interview, prepare to be astonished and amazed just at how varied and vast his career is. But that's in episode 21. Back to episode 20. Today's guest has a similar career to episode 21's guest in that it is vast and varied, but more so in another industry that I am totally obsessed with, comic books. And today's guest is none other than the incomparable Joseph Philip Illich. I met Joseph at the New York Comic Con in 2014, and it was at a panel having to do about the current state of the comic industry, and after the panel, we exchange contact information and have been intermediary connecting with each other via Twitter and email, talking about diversity in comics, as well as several other topics, including he's been giving me some great advice on and encouragement on getting my own graphic novel published, which is invaluable, and I'm very, very humbled that he has given me his time. You might be curious why I asked someone from the comic book industry to come on to a show that is predominantly about the animation industry. And it's mostly for the same reason why I invite people in the puppetry industry onto the show. Comic books are just another form of the illusion of life. And whether you know it or not, comic books are actually an integral part of the animation industry. I know you're probably scratching your heads and thinking I have gone cuckoo in the cabeza, but comic books are vital to the animation process. And the thing is they're not called comic books when it comes to animation. They're called something else. And it's actually a vital form of not only the animation process, but also the entire film industry. I bet you're kind of guessing at this point what it might be, but it is called the storyboard. Storyboards, for those who aren't too familiar with film terms, are basically the movie drawn out scene by scene by scene. So animators or actors or producers or directors have an idea of how they want camera shots, angles of the characters, lighting, special effects, sound effects, you know, so that they can kind of get a visual script of what they want to put into the show or the movie. In my opinion, comic books and graphic novels are just a more complete and final and more detailed version of storyboards. As much as I would like to say I came up with a comparison between storyboards and comic books, the idea actually came from Scott McCloud's great book, Understanding Comics. If you have absolutely no idea what comic books or graphic novels are, or you would like to learn, you should really check it out. I'll actually post an Amazon link to that in the show notes. To me, that was my Bible about comic books and graphic novels for years, and is still a great primer. But back to Joseph. The second reason I also invited Joseph on the show is because he worked at Milestone Media, the company that created one of my favorite superheroes, Static Shock. For those of you who don't know, Static Shock is this fabulous African-American teenage superhero who starred in his own TV series that became part of the renowned DC animated universe back in the early 2000s. The way I was introduced to DC Comics was via the DC animated universe, which started with Batman the Animated Series. It was mostly due to the DC animated universe that I picked up more DC comics, mostly the Batman series, because of how much I love the DC animated universe, Batman the Animated Series. And unbeknownst to me is that Joseph was responsible for the series that really captured my attention at that time, No Man's Land Saga. And I felt that it was a direct continuation of the animated series. This is my own thoughts and opinions on this, but I felt that it carried the same tone that the cartoon had. And when I met Joseph, I had no idea that he was responsible for it. But he was part of the editorial team that really helped reshape Batman into the modern character that he is today. And you can still see the influences of Joseph's editorial skills on, you know, the most current incarnations, even in the New 52, the recent line of Batman movies that came out a few years ago, and even the new DC animated Batman movies that are coming out from Warner Brothers Animation. But enough about Batman. Joseph, he was the editor over at Archaea Entertainment for a while, and he's currently writing his own graphic novel project about the Harlem Renaissance. But you don't need me to tell you what he is working on. Why don't you give the interview a listen and hear it in Joseph's own work.
My name is Joseph Philip Village. I am a writer, editor, and columnist. I write a weekly column for comic book resources called The Mission, which is about diversity in comics and entertainment. I am a freelance editor, and I am a writer. I am presently working on the Ren which is a graphic novel that takes place during the Harlem Renaissance, which is being published by First Second. It was created and co-written by my business partner, Sean Martinbro, and illustrated by Gray Williamson. And I am also writing a mini-series called Solar Man with Brendan Dineen. And Solar Man is basically a race-bending revamp on an old 90s Marvel series that only lasted 2 issues that Stan Lee wrote and had an animated pilot. So it gives us a lot of room in which to modernize the character. And by race-bending the character and making him a young black teenager, we can have a fun story that speaks to some social issues that are going on in America today.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show is because you were one of the main people who helped create one of my favorite superheroes from the DC Animated Universe, Static Shock.
Okay, all right. Thank you. To be fair, I was not one of the creators of Static. Static Shock, originally called Static, was created in the 90s by the founders of Milestone Media, who were Dwayne McDuffie, Derek Dingle, Dennis Cowan, Michael Davis, and Christopher Priest. And Static was significantly based on co-founder Michael Davis's family life. And various members of the family are named after Michael's mother, Michael's sister. My involvement with Milestone is that I was, I guess, the second generation staff, even though I started as an intern and worked my way up when the company launched its comic books in 1993. And I started in the business section, and then I moved over and became an editor. And I actually got to write an issue of Static, which was great because he's a well-beloved character. So it was my honor to write a story about him. And I've been really pleased to see him extend into an award-winning animated series, to appear in various comic books in the DC universe through various revamps, and the talk about the upcoming Warner Brothers digital live-action Static series. So being able to write Static and being able to work at Milestone that created Static has been really rewarding in the sense of seeing everything that has happened with the character since the company first started publishing comics on him in 1993.
Yeah, and what I enjoyed about him when he was on the show and when I read some of the comic books was, I'll admit I'm a white woman, when I first learned about him, I was a white teenager, but I found him easier to identify with than all the other superheroes on TV, except for, you know, something from Japanese anime, because he was a kid my age. He didn't have any tragic past. I know his mom died, but he was growing up in suburbia, and he was just an average, really intelligent kid, and that really spoke to me. And plus, he's still cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the core of Static is the understanding that you have to define yourself, and you can't let other people define you. You can't let other people tell you whether you're cool or not, whether you're black enough or not, whether you matter or not. And so Static at its core was about growing up, but it was about finding that sense of self-confidence in your abilities, whether those abilities are superpowers, whether those abilities are exceptional intelligence. And, you know, when you're younger, you're going to go through a lot of trials and verbal abuse and sometimes physical threats. And the courage and the intelligence to be able to stand up to that and to sometimes navigate yourself around it is very important and very essential to, I would imagine, the story of any teenager. So Static, to me, was an accurate reflection of that.
Yeah, and he was, I think, he was a very, very accurate representation of the teenagers and young kids, what was that, the early 2000s? More so than, I think, than a lot of cartoons, because, yeah, he was a superhero, but he was just very realistic, and I like that about him.
I agree. He was definitely identifiable. You don't have to be black or you don't have to be male to be able to identify with the kind of things that the character, whose real name is Virgil Hawkins, went through in his life. He was fortunate enough to be part of a nuclear family, so he had his mom and his dad and his sister, at least in the original Milestone comics. I feel like, unless I'm misremembering, that when DC revamped their universe in 2011 for the New 52, I feel like his mom might have been dead.
I think she was also dead in the TV show, too, because I remember an episode where he had to go back in time, and he tried to prevent his mom's death.
Oh, okay, which is a shame, because the black nuclear family, I don't know how statistically prominent it is, but that's something that should be seen. A variety of family dynamics should be seen, and I think, unfortunately, when you see black teenagers represented in American superhero comic books, the tendency is that they are not members of a complete family unit. So the fact that when Static was created and originally published, he was part of a complete family unit, I think is really unique and special in American superhero comic books, and I wish it had been maintained throughout the various media translations and representations, and I hope in the upcoming live-action Static show that his father and mother and sister will all be alive.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing that because, again, it's just a great character, and I am so glad that they just haven't, you know, shelved him or had him killed off or something like that, because it was a great show, it was a great concept, and I think it still is a very realistic, he's a very realistic hero. I can imagine, out of all the heroes, him being around, I mean, I know there's some sort of mutation going on, but I don't know. He's more realistic than I could say Superman or Batman.
Well, certainly more than Superman for a number of reasons. More than Batman, I don't know. I think he's more relatable than Batman because most people do not have the kind of material wealth that Batman does. But Batman has his own level of reality and groundedness. It'll be interesting to see what is done with Static in the upcoming Milestone 2.0 relaunch to see how Static is represented in the world of today by the company that launched him and created him.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think of it like that. Now, you used to be a former Batman editor at DC Comics. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the milestones you had when you were the Batman editor and how you were able to shape the character?
When I started working on Batman, we were in a year-long event called No Man's Land, which was a more realistic approach to superheroes because basically Gotham City had suffered a biochemical outbreak and a earthquake. And a result of those two things, the United States government considered it a biohazard zone in relation to the rest of the United States and basically destroyed the bridges that led into and outside of Gotham City and left the people there to their own devices. And it basically reduced Gotham City to a feudal society in which the legend of the Batman had to be reintegrated into society, and the various villains and police force basically created fiefdoms. They created houses. So it was really a story about the soul of Gotham City, the relationship between Batman and Commissioner Gordon, and how people survive under extraordinary conditions that have nothing to do with superpowers. And so during that time, we tried a lot of different ideas. We dealt with creators whom had never really dealt with Batman before. And as a result, when we came out of No Man's Land and we relaunched the entire Batman universe, we added some more diverse characters to the cast. We added Detective Crispus Allen, who's African-American and appears on the Gotham television series on Fox. We developed an Asian Batgirl, Cassandra Cain, and she was well-received, even though we really had to put up a fight with the powers that be to have an Asian Batgirl because they were very much stuck on a Caucasian redhead Batgirl. But the public really embraced Cassandra Cain, and Cassandra Cain is still in comics to this day. And writers such as Gail Simone really helped keep her alive in the various incarnations of the DC Comics superhero universe. And we got to create Batman titles that had different identities. One was really a detective crime noir book. One was more superheroic. And one was a bit more, I guess, esoteric and dealt with more metaphysical or supernatural ideas. So that was Detective Comics, Batman, and Gotham Knights, respectively. And I became the editor of Birds of Prey, so I was able to work regularly with Black Canary and Oracle. Oracle's one of my favorite characters in comics. And the first time that Oracle confronted the Joker after he crippled her happened during my editorial run of Birds of Prey, and it happened shortly after No Man's Land. So there were a variety of good, dramatic things that we were able to do in terms of story. We were able to expand the cultural diversity of the cast of characters of Gotham City and make impact that is now being seen in television shows, has been seen in animated films. There was a animated series on DVD called Gotham Knights. It was basically six animated shorts, and it took place between the first two Christopher Nolan Batman films, and Crispus Allen appeared in those as well, and it was great to see him there. So it's great to see the things that you work on have a life beyond your time working on them.
Wow. You know what? That was actually one of my favorite periods during the Batman comic. And, well, the fact that...
Thank you. We all worked very hard on it. And it's actually one of my favorites as well.
Well, it should be, because that was probably... I mean, I think one of... And this is just my opinion. Some of the things that really shaped the Batman character in the past, let's see, I'm going to say 20 years, just to give us a round sum, has been the Batman animated TV series, which really took him out of the campiness, and really that was just an awesome show. And then the way the comics were handled during that time, because what I really liked is it was a succinct, consistent story. The characters were growing. The characters were developing. We didn't just have one Robin and one Batman. Yes, we had Robin Batman, but he changed. He had to deal with his own stuff. And then we had the different Robins going in, and then Cassandra Cain. Oh, I love Cassandra. And what I've always found completely interesting was how Oracle was how Barbara Gordon, how she was injured, and then nothing magically healed her, that she was kept in a wheelchair but was still able to be a crime-fighting heroine while doing that. And I'm getting chills just thinking about those good memories. Well, just the good stories, I could say.
Yeah, I think that Barbara Gordon was actually a more powerful and more important character as Oracle than she ever could be as Batgirl. Mm-hmm. And it was really disappointing to me when, as a result of the DC Comics universe revamped in 2011 with the New 52, that she was basically returned to Batgirl. And I can understand why it was done from a business standpoint, from a marketing standpoint. There are a number of fans who are obviously very excited about it because Batgirl, as far as I can tell, has healthy sales to this day. But I really felt like she was more symbolic as Oracle. And unfortunately, I don't think that there are enough superhero characters to represent the disabled community that losing one is trivial in its ratio, in its percentage. So I feel like, unfortunately, that was a loss.
Yeah, there is some things that are happening now and then, New 52, that I'm kind of creeped out about. I mean, the way they're handling the Joker now, I mean, Mark Hamill will always be my Joker. And Heath Ledger, I mean, he was just a creepy guy, but the Joker now is going to such extremes, and it makes, I mean, the dude's a really, really bad villain. Well, not a bad villain, he's just really evil, and it just makes me wish someone that they would try him in court and be able to keep him locked up and maybe even give him the death penalty. I mean, I know that's comics, but I'm thinking of this from a real-life perspective. What are your thoughts on the Joker?
I can't accept the Joker anymore for similar reasons to what you just said. You know, the Birds of Prey arc that I mentioned earlier, in which Barbara confronts the Joker basically tried to murder the entire population of Manhattan, New York City. And I understand that to Batman, life is sacred. You know, his father was a doctor. So that, I guess, Hippocratic oath is intrinsic in Batman's ideology and ethos. And anybody who works as part of the Batman team would have to share that ethos. However, the world, I think, would put the Joker to death the same way they judged someone like Saddam Hussein. And I understand that the Joker cannot be killed, but my suspension of disbelief with that character has reached its limit, and it's one of the reasons why, unfortunately, I don't think any writer can tackle the Joker and convince me of a resolution, make me feel anything about his supposed death. I honestly don't really feel anything for the character anymore. I have no interest in reading more Joker stories. I did find the Brian Azzarello Joker graphic novel interesting. I did find the Scott Snyder Death of the Family storyline interesting because there was something that Joker was trying to accomplish. I honestly did not read the Endgame storyline. I've read a few issues after Endgame, so it's clear that the latest battle between Batman and the Joker had a significant impact on Gotham City and both of those characters. But that's a hard character for me to feel any connection to anymore. Mm-hmm. Insofar as how he's going to be portrayed in Suicide Squad, I'm sure that Jared Leto is going to bring it, because Jared Leto is an amazing actor. All you have to do is see Dallas Buyers Club or see Requiem for a Dream to see his amazing abilities. So I'm sure he's going to take ownership of the Joker and make him his mm-hmm. own. So I'm very interested to see Suicide Squad next year.
Oh, yeah. What I'm very glad about is the DC animation department is there. In Bruce Timm's own words, they're the best animation studio out there. Now, to me, I'm just going to insert one of the best animation studios in parentheses there, because there are so many great studios. But when it comes to being able to face down Disney's Marvel, DC Animation at Warner Brothers, they are able to do it. And what really is making me happy is with all these Disney live-action Marvel movies, is Disney is bringing their own game, and Marvel's like, I mean, Disney's and DC's like, okay, well, we do a great job when it comes to our animated films that we release direct to DVD, so let's do the same thing with our live-action movies. And so DC, I think, is just going to bring it, and I'm just so excited to see the Suicide Squad and the future projects they have, because I don't think they're going to have the same campiness as the stuff from, let's say, the 90s.
Well, beyond a shadow of a doubt, you can look at the trailers for the upcoming DC Universe films, and you can see that there is no campiness whatsoever. I'm really thrilled about Suicide Squad because, number one, it seems like they're going to push the envelope in terms of the maturity of content. Number two, seeing Harley Quinn on screen, because it was during my editorial run on the Batman books during No Man's Land, is when Harley Quinn was brought into the mainstream DC universe. She was first introduced in comics in the animated DC comics in a critically acclaimed and wonderfully written one-shot called Mad Love. But in terms of being brought into the serious mainstream superhero continuity, that first happened during No Man's Land in a one-shot called Batman Harley Quinn, which mm-hmm. was written by Harley Quinn's creator, Paul Dini, and illustrated by Yvel Goucher. And Alex Ross did a great cover in which he did an homage to a famous J.C. Leyendecker, I think, illustration. And so having worked on bringing Harley Quinn into the serious DC superhero universe and seeing her now being realized in live action with what seems to be a degree of complexity in her characterization, it's really exciting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's awesome. It's exciting. We could probably go back and forth. You get a thesaurus, I get a thesaurus, and we could go back and forth and just insert verbs about how we're feeling about the new Suicide Squad movie.
It's true. It's true. I'm really looking forward to that. Maybe more so than Batman versus Superman, if that's possible. I may be looking forward to Suicide Squad more. And so 2016 is going to be exciting. It's going to be really interesting for those two films, for DC fans, and for Marvel Studios, quite frankly, because they're going to see if DC is able to really compete with them after the Christopher Nolan Batman era. So
let's see. I'm not much of a betting person, and I'm not going to make any bets on it, but I think if there's any company who can give Disney a run for its money when it comes to Marvel, DC will do it, because they got Superman, they have Batman, they have Wonder Woman, and these guys, I mean, they're just part of American culture, and I would just say they're fantastic characters, and they're going to bring it.
We're going to find out. We'll find out in a year if they do that. So
yeah.
It'll be good.
So let's talk about some of your more current projects. You're working on this fantastic graphic novel from one of my favorite publishers, First Second, Ren. And it's about the Harlem Renaissance. Can you tell me a bit more about the story?
I can. It's called The Ren, which is short for The Renaissance. And it's a teenage love story about a young bass player from Augusta, Georgia, who moves to Harlem with dreams of becoming a big-time musician. And he meets and develops a romantic relationship with a teenage girl who has dreams of becoming a dancer, and she's a Harlem native. And it's really about what they go through in their relationship with the backdrop of everything that's happening in Harlem from 1925 to 1926. And part of the reason it came about is because my co-writer, Sean Martinborough, and I realized that we did not see any black teenage romance in comics. We really couldn't think of any. I mean, we talked about Static earlier. Even Static, now Static ended up, his first official girlfriend was a black girl named Daisy, but his first love was a white girl named Frida. So even with Static, for most of his history, it was an interracial relationship, which I can identify with now because I'm in an interracial relationship. But in terms of black and black romance among teenagers, we did not see that in comics. So we wanted to do that. Since we're both creative people, we wanted this to be a story about creative people, and we figured there would be no better time to tell that story than in the Harlem Renaissance, which was basically a confluence in history of creative people coming together in New York, in Harlem, and starting a movement, which was originally called the New Negro Movement, but later on would be called the Harlem Renaissance. So it's a 200 to 215-page graphic novel. It's being illustrated by Gray Williamson, who is an amazing illustrator. He's done work for DC Comics. He's done work for Valiant. He just put out his own graphic novel called Valmar, V-A-L-M-A-R, which can be bought for the Amazon Kindle. And all of three of us are black men born and raised in New York City. So for three black New York natives to be able to tell this story about black history that took place in New York is amazing. And we're really happy to be doing it with First Second. First Second is one of my favorite publishers as well, not just because they're publishing the book, but because they are committed to stories about diversity in a variety of contexts. American-born Chinese, which was done by a friend of mine, Gene Wen Yang, is to me one of the most important graphic novels in the last 15 years.
Oh, I love that graphic novel.
To speak about cultural identity and speak about the dichotomy of being someone of a nationality that is not American and living in America and dealing with that clash. And I'm reading The Sculptor by Scott McCloud right now.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is also by First Second. It really is an impressive piece of work. I feel like The Sculptor is for the next 5 years what David Mazzucchelli's Asterios Polyp was for the last 5 years, which is a real graphic novel that is kind of like, I don't know, it's just this representation of somebody's work. You see something like Asterios Polyp or you see something like The Sculptor, and those are the ultimate resumes of both of those gentlemen, and you get a sense of what they care about.
Mm-hmm.
So it is my hope that The Wren will stand next to those books and be part of an educational narrative in various high schools and various colleges and introduce young people to the Harlem Renaissance, because I don't feel like that's a part of history that is profiled enough. And so I'm looking forward to The Wren coming out in either late 2016 or early 2017 and making that kind of an impact in a real world sense.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons, I mean, I've talked about with you my own graphic novel. It's more of it's a young adult graphic novel that's kind of a fantasy, and it was made for girls. And, I mean, I can see some boys enjoying it, too. But one of the main things about it is I don't have any overt romance in it. And one of the things that is driving me crazy about the young adult books these days is all the ones for girls are just making them seem like they're going to find their true love as a teenager, which I think is highly unrealistic and very, very an unhealthy aspect of life, way to look at life, because they're going to grow, they're going to change, and most often than not, they're not going to find a boy that young at that time. But so it's more or less take your traditional adventure story for a boy, but insert a girl main character, and there was my adventure.
Okay. Understood. Well, it's interesting because I don't think there's ever been more stories by women about women or about girls in the American comic book industry than there is right now. But certainly there are more stories to be told, and the experiences of teenage girls is so widely varied and complex that no five stories could totally relay the experience. So, you know, you have to do yours. You have to do yours and contribute to the discussion.
Mm-hmm. And so, that's the thing. You're going to find more female written stories that aren't necessarily overtly romance and more adventure driven in, you know, graphic novels, and you are going to find them in actual prose novels.
Right. Nope. I hear you. I still have to do a lot of investigation in that area. I just gave my fiance Lumberjanes.
Oh.
And so when she's done with Lumberjanes, I will read Lumberjanes, or we may read it together, because sometimes before we go to bed at night, we'll read a graphic novel together, or we'll read two scenes, and then the next night we'll read two more scenes. So who knows? Maybe we'll be reading Lumberjanes at the same time. And so I have a lot of investigating to do in that area of comics, which just seems to be exploding, and quite frankly, it's about time.
I know. You should also read, there's this really great graphic novel, I think it's from IDW, called Chikakabra, and it's about a girl who, she basically becomes an incarnate for the Chupacabra, and she just goes about using her powers to kind of fight crime, but not necessarily fight crime, and she just is dealing with having the spirit of a mythical creature living inside of her. And I forgot who the artist is, but it's really well done. Very, very good texture. I love it. It's a really great book.
Okay, what's it called again?
Chikakabra.
Okay, I will look for it.
Yeah. Oh, and you should also take a look at Princeless. I can send you a link to that.
Princeless, I have read. I'm friends with Jeremy Whitley, the creator, and what happened was my fiance Lulu and I met Jeremy and his wife at the East Coast Black Age of Comics convention, I believe back in 2012, and my fiance saw Princeless and thought it was really interesting. We looked through it and we bought the first volume. We immediately fell in love with it, and shout out to Jeremy because he's one of the writers in the reportedly sold out Secret Wars Secret Love comic that just dropped, where he wrote an interesting love story with Misty Knight and Iron Fist, and about the daughter that they had together and raised. And the book is really getting a lot of critical acclaim. Reportedly, the first printing has already sold out on the distributor level. I hope I can find a copy tomorrow, but Princeless is great. It's a great comic book, and I would like to see something like that put in schools. I would like to see girls of all nationalities reading a comic book like Princeless, because the theme of, again, defining who you are and not defining yourself by the expectations of others, the same way a theme like that is present in Static, it is present even more so in Princeless. And It's a great all-ages story with themes that everyone can understand.
I agree totally with that statement. And you said it very, very well. So on that thought, we are rounding up this interview, but do you mind if I ask you one last question? And it's one I've asked of everyone, and it's one I plan to ask of every other guest who appears on future episodes. Do you have anything to declare?
Anything to declare? Wow. You know, the only thing I think I would have to declare at this time is a need for a friendlier comic book industry, a more respectful comic book industry, and an end to victimizers, an end to stalkers, and it's something that affects all of us, whether we are the direct recipients of this or not, and it has to come to an end because this industry has the capacity to be an amazing place and an amazing refuge, mm-hmm. and we don't need it to be spoiled. So I declare a desire for a better comic book industry, and I hope we can all work together to make that happen.
Yeah, I hope to. I hope to be part of that. I'm working on it.
Me too.
I know you're already working on it too. So I thank you for the work you're doing, and I'm thanking you for coming on the show. And you know, you're just an all around really fun guy to talk to.
Thank you very much. It's my honor to be on the show, and it's really fun talking with you.
Welcome to the Bottom of the Tune In Talk podcast, and once more, I extend my gratitude to Joseph for appearing on the show and giving me a bit more of his time. I had a fantastic time talking about Static, Batman, the Joker, and especially your new graphic novel, The Wren from First Second. Ladies and gentlemen, if you aren't familiar with First Second Publishing, it's my favorite independent comic book publisher. They produce anything from, every single genre. It can be science fiction, children's, historical, autobiographical. I mean, you can all find it from First Second. And what's great about their comics is they're so diverse that whenever you pick one up, it's never going to look like something that has already come before. And I think The Wren is going to be a great addition to their wheelhouse, especially with such a creative idea. A romance happening in New York during the Harlem Renaissance. I mean, I haven't heard that idea before. It's original, and I'm looking forward to reading it. Kudos to me for getting my graphic novels early before they release on the publishing date, because I review them over at Fanboy Nation. Speaking of Fanboy Nation, it's time for the bump.
Excelsior, Imperius Rex, live long and prosper, up, up, and away. Now that's my personal favorite. Fanboy Nation is go. Welcome to Fanboy Nation magazine, the home of all things fanboy and fangirl, not just the same stuff you can get anywhere else. Only at Fanboy Nation will we go beyond the generic questions of, so what's your favorite pencil? What kind of strings do you use? And how did it feel when you put on X costume? We give you insight into the lives of the artists, producers, the movers, the shakers, the indies, up-and-comers, the bigwigs, and most importantly, the little guys. If you haven't gotten yourself over to fanboynation.com, you need to do it today.
I do review comic books and interview comic creators over at Fanboy Nation. I do admit I've been a bit slow during the past year because of my book, but I'm working on getting that done. Speaking of done, I didn't do the housekeeping at the beginning of the show, so let's do it now. I mentioned in one of my last podcasts that I was working on a store with a focus on animation. And I have completed my Amazon store. In it, you're going to find a selection of animation history books, Disney history books, art books, voiceover recording equipment. I've been doing a little bit of research into voiceover artists and also, you know, podcasting because, you know, this is a podcast and I'm always looking for ways to improve the quality of my work. And so that's all going to be available there. Take a look. A lot of those books are ones that I have personally read or am reading or have come across in some way. Others are based off popular reviews from other people. While I was assembling my store, one of the funny things I noticed is that there appears to be more books written about Disney history than there is about animation history in general. Now, this could be because of the way my search results were aggregated, but from my own research about animation history, I do believe my observations are accurate, that there are more books about Disney history than general animation industry just because of the powerhouse that Disney is. No other studio, to my knowledge, has their own publishing house. I mean, Disney has Hyperion Publishing and Disney Editions and Disney Publishing. Those are all under the Disney umbrella. I've never heard of DreamWorks Publishing. I've never heard about Warner Brothers Publishing. They always branch out and license their characters to publishing houses. Disney also has their own fully equipped research archive with historians on staff, and they also make an effort to hire people to write books about Disney history who are experts in their field, or they have on staff writers do it. So Disney, it's part of the Disney marketing campaign to make and continue to spread the legend of Walt Disney. And it's been very effective. I get about that a little bit in my book about Lotte Reiniger, so I won't go on any more of it. But take a look at the store, and you might be pleasantly surprised about what you find in there. I know I was when I was assembling it. I'll post a link to the new Tune In Talk Amazon store in the show notes. The show notes for episode 20 will be available in one of two places. One is www.fanboynation.com. Just click on podcasts and tune in talk. And they will also be available at www.tuneintalk.com. If you are interested in connecting with me or Joseph, I will be putting both of our contact information in the show notes as well. My own personal Twitter handle is one of two. You can contact me personally at Story Sequence, or you can contact the show's Twitter handle, which is at Tune In Talk. Also, I would love for you to drop me a line via email, and I would love to hear your opinions about who you would love to see on the show, commentary on the show, and, you know, just ask me general questions about, you know, practically anything, and I would love to hear from you. The email for the show is tuneintalk@gmail.com. And if you are interested in showing your support of the show, one of the easiest ways you can do that is subscribe to us via Stitcher or via iTunes. The more you leave us a rating or review, the further we're pushed up in the charts, and it would encourage more people to listen to the show, which I am always a big fan of. And so that wraps about up everything for another episode of the Tune In Talk podcast. And now, if you'll excuse me, I've got to go put a shock in your system and read comic books at the same time. Catch you in episode 21, everyone.